You're listening to Root Cause Remedies, a show that explores environmental justice from right here in Hawaii. I'm Tina Grandinetti, and I'll be your humble host and fellow traveler on this huaka'i to learn more about the issues that affect the lands, waters, and people that sustain us. Hey, everybody. Oh, man, it's been a while since we've dropped an episode. Not gonna lie, a lot longer than we planned, but you know what? We're living in a pandemic and shit's happening, so we're just rolling with the punches here. However, this episode is 100% worth the wait. This week, Anna Chua took over Root Cause Remedies as our very first guest host. Anna is usually the brains behind our social media channels, but this week she sat down with Shayna Lonoea Alexander to talk about abolition and policing during the pandemic. Shayna works as a field organizer for ACLU Hawaii's Smart Justice Campaign, which is part of a movement to decarcerate Hawaii by 50% while challenging the racial disparities among Native Hawaiians and Pacific Islanders impacted by the criminal legal system. But her work really goes so much deeper than that. As an organizer and activist, she's been working incredibly hard, especially during the course of the pandemic, to help move our island community towards an abolitionist vision of our future. Abolition is an idea that a lot of us just started getting more familiar with this year, thanks to the movement for Black Lives. So what is it? To borrow a definition from the group Critical Resistance, abolition is a political vision with the goal of eliminating imprisonment, policing, and surveillance, and creating lasting alternatives to punishment and imprisonment. The way I've come to understand it is as a transformative vision for a world in which we respond to community needs through care rather than through punishment. And in this episode, Shayna shares her thinking on what abolition looks and feels like when we're grounded here in Hawaii, in our communities, our histories, and in this aina. We got the idea for this episode after watching a TikTok Shayna made to address the horrific racial disparities of policing during the pandemic. Right here in Hawaii, the pandemic has fed into the prison industrial complex by fueling massive amounts of money to the police, while our communities remain in desperate need of financial care and support. HPD received $43 million in federal COVID-19 aid. $43 million, while thousands of people, our friends, our families, our neighbors, maybe some of you listening right now, were and still are being totally failed by our unemployment system, falling behind on rents and mortgages, wondering how they're going to feed their families. And how was that $43 million used? Well, as you'll hear in this episode, Black and Samoan people were disproportionately arrested for violating COVID-19 stay-at-home orders, and Micronesians were 30 times more likely to be arrested than white people. Meanwhile, Mayor Kirk Caldwell made a media stunt of passing out free masks to mostly white tourists in Waikiki. And inside Hawaii prisons, massive outbreaks are taking place, and the mayor's response to that was to argue that those cases shouldn't be counted in our weekly averages. What that's really saying is that those lives don't count. But he's not alone. It's not just him. What we'll talk about in this episode is that our entire society is structured to teach us that people in prisons are unworthy. I listened to this episode while I was walking in the middle of the day in the hot sun, and I still got chills. I'm talking major chicken skin because Shayna speaks so powerfully and beautifully about how prisons and policing deprive people of their humanity and how this kind of like radiates out into the rest of our society so that it impacts not just people in prison, but our everyday lives. And the pandemic really makes that more clear than ever. After I finished the episode, I kind of just took a deep breath and had to process for a second. Because sometimes, and especially lately, it's really hard not to fall into this cynicism about people, not just society, but about people, about how cruel and self-serving we can be. But Shayna reminded me that the counter to that is that people have this immense capacity to care for and love each other, all of us. Every single one of us has that. We just need to do the work to get to a place where we can take that seriously. And we deserve a world like that. Ugh. Thank you, Shayna. It was just really what I needed to hear as we step into a new year. And to all of our listeners, I hope you feel the same.
My name is Shayna Lonai Alexander. I'm born and raised on Oahu. I'm originally from Waihoa. I'm here to talk about policing and abolition and the intersections of environmental injustice, but I also work for the American Civil Liberties Union of Hawaii, organizing to end mass incarceration and bring about police accountability.
That is awesome. That kind of leads us to a lot of what we want to talk about today, which is policing and abolition, and especially how that applies in Hawaii and the environmental justice movement, the racial justice movement. And so abolition is a term that a lot of people either don't understand or have misconceptions about or get kind of scared of because of how we've been socialized to believe or the status quo is. And even myself, I learned about abolition in an environmental justice class, and so I very much have seen it through a capitalist settler colonial lens. And despite that, I am still admittedly feel a little scared thinking about abolition and what a world post-abolition looks like. And so can you tell us a little bit about what abolition means to you and why do you think it matters?
So I hear that fear. I'm not in the same place I was even a year ago when it came to abolition. I honestly didn't know what it meant, and everything sounded so wild. Like, I had a very basic understanding that it wasn't cool for the U.S. to overthrow Hawaii. Like, it wasn't cool that the state is using cops to arrest people for protecting Aina. And I knew it wasn't okay that Hawaiians and Pacifica make up nearly half of the incarcerated population, but only 20% of the total population of Hawaii. And I guess, like, it wasn't until I understood that actually addressing those issues, right, sovereignty is abolition, protecting the Mauna Aloha Aina is abolition. We're saying that we love each other and the Aina too much to pretend that what we have now is good enough. And I guess, like, what helped me jump into abolition is I started getting really frustrated that I was being spoon-fed ideas that felt like a very watered-down version of how to make things better for myself and for the people I care about, right? Like, growing up, this might sound silly, but growing up, my mom would water down, like, my fruit punch, and I couldn't stand it because once I discovered how sugary and good straight from the can, like, Hawaiian Sun was, I was like, can get that watery juice out of my face, right? Yeah, and I think that this is probably a bad metaphor, but I'm running with it. To finally have the source, like, that juice was just so sweet and fine. Like, abolition allowed me to be creative and curious and caring for others and myself. And, you know, and that fundamentally, abolition is the idea that no one is disposable and everyone is valued and loved, and we strive to make that true every day.
I love that. And I love that you've also just kind of painted a picture of your journey through understanding abolition. And I would love to hear also about how you got involved with organizing around abolition, and how is that changed your viewpoint on abolition thus far?
Yeah, like I said, I've really only come into it very recently, but I think what grounds me is that what is political is very personal. I come from a very big family. I am the oldest of seven. I have more cousins and aunties and uncles than I can count. And my parents both grew up struggling in Waihoa. My mom is Samoan and Filipino. And my dad is a Black Kanaka man who's been incarcerated and institutionalized for basically my entire life. I think of how, like, the first time I really remember my dad, like, hugging my dad, I was 11 years old at my grandma's funeral. I wore a white mu'umu lei, and he was in a jumpsuit shackled at the feet and waist. Like, to this day, I can still remember how big the guns were that the armed guards were carrying, and the way that my dad had to shuffle through the church at my grandma's funeral. And like thousands of kids in Hawaii, I grew up learning about my dad through phone calls and letters and hospital visits. So over a year ago, I was living in Wyoming, And my employer was looking for someone who's impacted by the carceral system and wanted to organize. And I had saw the live streams of Kukuna and Kia'i putting their bodies, their lives in the line for the Mauna. And in them, I saw my dad and knew what they were signing up for. What an arrest and criminal record could do to your life. So I thought if I could come home and do any work to help them, to like help free our people, like then yes, like of course I'm here. That's kind of what helped me bridge over into it.
Yeah, thank you for sharing that. Our stories ground us, and I really appreciate the connections you make between your lived experiences and why abolition is so needed. And that kind of leads us into thinking about how racial, economic, environmental injustices play out on systemic levels and how that almost necessitates abolition. Especially this year, we've witnessed a sharp increase in the militarization of the police. While unfortunately that's really nothing new, it does show us how marginalized communities are deemed as expendable and inferior under the nation-state regime. So can you tell us a little bit about how specifically in Hawaii, the state has weaponized COVID to further inflict harm upon Native Hawaiian and Pacific Islander communities?
Yeah, I think that's such a big question, but I think that we're all experiencing it and we're all seeing it, which is so frustrating, right? Like Native Hawaiians and Pacific Islanders are at such a distressing high risk of catching and dying from COVID-19. And I'm speaking as someone who's survived COVID earlier this year. And we know from I think as of December 2nd, that Native Hawaiian and Pacific Island communities in the U.S. have faced about over 30,000 positive cases and over 360 deaths. And this is data coming out of a Pacific Islander COVID-19 response team. And, they looked at the data across the states and with our people in them, and they found this horrific trend. We make up less than 1% of the total U.S. population. In Hawaii, last month we saw data come out from UH stating Asians are at an increasing risk of COVID positive cases and death. Filipinos account for 21% of cases in Hawaii, while representing just 16% of the population. I think, this speaks to the fact that we live in large multi-generational homes. We're at high risk because many of us don't have access to affordable quality healthcare, we're living paycheck to paycheck, we're eating foods our ancestors could not stomach, and we're coping with displacement and separation in a lot of ways because, a lot of us just can't afford to live in our ancestral land. And I think of how many of our loved ones are working essential jobs, having to catch public transportation or rotting away in a cage. And the state, instead of ensuring that all of us have food, that all of us have shelter, that all of us have an education and healthcare, they've been just placating the tourism industry and the military and law enforcement, which are industries that come at such an immeasurable environmental and human life cost. The state has $1.2 billion right now in CARES Act funding, and only as of 2 days ago were they committed to spending it all. Meanwhile, people are becoming houseless. They're going without unemployment, and they're hitting up food pantries and mutual aid. Sorry, I can go all day, but we're looking at this huge, massive furlough of state workers that's happening next year. And state workers make up such a huge part of our workforce. And instead of during this entire time using the CARES Act funding or literally any funds into family assistance, or say things like reentry programs, like Fernhurst. Fernhurst is the only women's incarceration alternative in the state that reunites mothers with their children in our communities. We should be investing in that, programs that are designed to set people up for success and help build resiliency through this difficult time. But we have policymakers who've decided it's easier and much more profitable to separate our families, sever our ties to the land and cycle the most marginalized of us, women, children, elderly, queer and trans people, people with disabilities, and people experiencing poverty through compassionate disruption, or this idea that we can just wait until they bounce back, or that we'll just open up again to tourism. It doesn't make any sense.
So state sanctioned marginalization of Native Hawaiian and Pacific Islander communities make it evident that the system that we live in, which upholds policing and mass incarceration, don't prioritize people and the land, and instead protect property and capital. So in your work, what are the ways that you've seen issues like mass incarceration and policing being connected to many other issues in Hawaii, like food insecurity, houselessness, the commodification of indigenous culture, and more?
I think that we always have to look at like why things exist in the first place. Yeah. Police are tasked with protecting power and privilege and property by exerting control over Black and brown bodies. Like, policing as an institution was founded in slave catching, in furthering the idea that Black people are property, that they are objects that need to be reined in whenever they assert their birthright of freedom. So it doesn't really come to a surprise for me that Honolulu police have the worst records for crime solving in the U.S., right? Like, each city made an arrest or solved a violent crime for every four that occurred in 2019, according to FBI data. And I think that speaks to the fact that crime solving is not really what cops are designed to do. Like, rarely does their job entail harm elimination or preventive care or any reconciliation, that their very presence is harmful, right? Like, we saw that with the death of Breonna Taylor, but we also saw that in Hawaii with Aaron Torres, who called 911 because he had a drug overdose. And the cop said he had died handcuffed, face down in the dirt, his legs shackled, with three cops pressed on his back outside of his Nanakuli home. Like, his death was ruled a homicide by HPD. According to HPD's data, 2012, when it had happened, that there was no records of police killings that year. So it's that thing of cops are severely underqualified to help people in crisis. Like, increasingly, their funding is going towards acquiring military weapons and training. And I think that we saw that on the Mauna. We saw that the Hawaii County Police issued over 4,000 citations during the demonstrations in an attempt to intimidate people from protecting the aina, right? We see that from a Uniform Information Practice Act request, where dozens and dozens of emails showed that cops were patting each other on the back for getting someone our tent, having their flag or seatbelts, like really, really minute shit like that. And we see that so clearly, like, to me, with like what happened with my Manalo, with Caldwell trying to go off ahead with the construction project. And oh my gosh, like, just talking about them here, and like the masks on the beach thing, like, like, while Uncle Caldwell was out there giving masks to people who could afford a vacation during a pandemic on the beach, like, his cops were out there pocketing like $32 million and gave out over 60,000 citations. Like, it just makes me upset. Like, and we know from their arrest data, they were 5 times more likely to arrest Black and Samoan people, 30 times more likely to arrest Micronesians than white people. And now dozens of cops in the COVID enforcement team are under investigation for overtime pay violations. And the police union is making sure we don't know what is happening with that for months. Police are used and how they like impact our relationships to land and everything. In Jamaica's episode, in prior episode, she talked about how aina is our literal relationship to the land. That is actually, like, it's recognized in our laws. In 1979, the law of the splintered paddle, decreed by Kamehameha I, said, "Let every elderly person, woman, and child lie by the roadside in safety." That's codified in the Hawaiian Constitution and in the Hawaii State Constitution. And also, the U.S. Supreme Court also recognizes people's innate right to be left alone and not punished for sleeping outdoors on public property when there aren't enough shelter beds. And in Hawaii, like on Oahu, like there aren't enough, they're just not. It's actually really super dangerous to be clearing people during this time. The CDC published guidelines on its website saying not to clear encampments. So that's like tent city, villages, pu'uhonuas, where houseless folks are living, because unless there's like individual housing units available, clearing these encampments or sweeps, or I like to call them evictions, can cause people to disperse throughout the community and break connection with service providers. So, and this only increases the potential for COVID-19 spread. You know, the CDC also provides guidance on how to encourage people to set up their shelters that are physically distanced and to encourage nearby restroom facilities to have working plumbing and sanitation products, which that was a huge fight earlier this year. Like the counties, like all of them, had shut down all of the public restrooms. It's just so negligent. And so, like, it doesn't make any... I keep saying, like, it doesn't make any sense because it's not, like...
From the evictions to the outbreaks in correctional facilities, how has the state or the city responded to calls to rectify these injustices and reconstruct or abolish the systems that clearly don't benefit communities?
I think, like, this, the state's response has been at times almost like it's like talking to a wall, like almost a bit of a no comment. And I think that's also fueled in part by the fact that there's so much stigma around incarceration. There's so much stigma around houselessness that we have a lot of policymakers that almost have permission from our neighbors to be assholes, right? Like, we look at Stolen Stuff Away on Facebook. Mm-hmm. We look at the comment sections of literally every news article talking about incarceration or COVID-19 or houselessness. Like, and I think as advocates, it then becomes our job to remind people of our connectedness and of aloha and that we really are in this all together.
And you've touched on this multiple times, but maybe tell us a little bit more about how these very deep-rooted systems in Hawaii leading back to colonialism and genocide and how all of these things kind of intersect and interconnect to maintain the status quo that we know of today. And in many ways, allow all these narratives through the media to be normalized and stuff like that.
Yeah, I think, you know, we inherited some really damaging systems of how we treat each other in the land. The first time many of our ancestors, when I think of it, like, interacted with each other, it was on sugar and pineapple plantations. They had to endure slave wages. You know, young women and girls were being child brides to these old dudes. We had this, like, huge racial stratification with light-skinned Asians at the top and Hawaiians at the bottom. And similar to how the origin of policing impacts us today, I think that same thing goes for this. Like, we're still trapped in this plantation era romanticism almost. Mm-hmm. And like, we've yet to reconcile that or really as a whole come together and talk about, like, the entire time that was happening to a lot of our ancestors. You know, the US imperialism was robbing us of our connectedness to each other and the aina. The white businessmen who staged the overthrow were local and spoke Hawaiian. Like, they weaponized every aspect of their identity and traditionality to Hawaii to strip Kanaka of nearly everything. Laws were imposed to make sure no one could speak and organize in Hawaiian or could participate in actions to support, you know, restoring the nation or you risked, like, losing your land. You risked getting arrested. Or you could have been killed. You know, not everyone survived that time. And it's from those bad ideas to those bad laws to what we see now, that is the status quo. We're facing a massive layoff next year. Local businesses have shut down and the state is scrambling to spend that $1.2 billion in CARES Act funding. And yet, you know, they still want to build a $500 million super jail in Halawa. There are over 4,100 people that are currently incarcerated in Hawaii. And every time now that we see a major, you know, spike in positive cases, it's coming from a carceral facility. And at this point, like, that lack of care to incarcerated people is basically the reason now we have to keep everything shut down. The cops refuse to let up on arrests and citations, cycling high-risk populations into constant contact with each other. The judges, the lawmakers, and prosecutors believe basically if you're mentally ill or poor, you belong in a cage and maybe that'll help straighten you out. And I think of, like, Saguaro, like the private prison, the contracts. Mm-hmm. In Arizona, and we've seen, you know, we have like over 1,000 people who are there, and we've heard everything from them not getting PPE or enough soap, but the state had the time and energy to have everyone fill out next of kin paperwork in case they died of COVID.
Exactly. The lack of care exists not just in the disproportionate distribution of funding, but also in the ways that narratives surrounding incarcerated people are degrading and dehumanizing. And to that, it's really distressing to think that tough on crime policies, for example, are still considered as an option to solve social issues created and upheld by the state. And despite all of that, alternative systems like Pu'uhonua have exemplified that a post-abolition world can and does exist and is possible. And yet it's continuously threatened by the state. So how do we continue reimagining alternative ways of living in a system that continuously dismantles our dreams and devalues our communities?
Honestly, we just need to defund the police and defund public safety and start all over. Like, it's come to this point where it is such a massive waste of effort and time to try to fix these institutions that aren't, like, they're not as old as time. Like, they literally have just been imposed very recently. Mm-hmm. And just because it is what we have done doesn't mean it is the best thing to do. Doesn't mean that it's a good idea, right? Like, I think about how, you know, reform is often well-intentioned and requires us to try to fix and invest in the systems that are born from harmful and expensive and these, like, downright mean ideas. Reform says to us, either ignore or idolize the U.S. coming in here, arresting and incarcerating our queen, overthrowing our nation, stripping us of land, language, and basic sovereignty, right? Like, it wants us to not look at these white supremacist and imperialist actions and focus on fixes that will help just some of us survive, right? It becomes all about making sure a little bit more of us can make rent, a little bit more of us can protect the Aina, a little bit more of us can survive an interaction with the racist thought that abolition calls on us to look at Hawaii's history and our abusive relationship with the U.S. and with punishment and justice and say, actually, I'd like to free all of us, that we deserve more than just to survive. And I'm going to honor our kupuna and their ike and their trauma and their survival and their resistance to the U.S. empire by doing away with what harmed them and continues to harm us. That with everyone I love, I'm going to build something where we all thrive. And I think that distinction lies in, are we willing in this moment to maintain the status quo, or do we want to get rid of what doesn't serve us and imagine different, better ways to care for each other?
That's beautiful. And I think what's so great about abolition and why I am so curious and intrigued by it and want to learn so much about it is because it connects so many issues, not just in Hawaii, but pretty much globally. And, you know, white supremacy, as we've seen, especially this year, exists like around the whole world. And abolition seeks to not just abolish that or reinvent how we view ethnicity and relationships and stuff like that, but also just understand that capital wealth, for example, shouldn't be central to our existence. And yeah, I just think that when we make that connection, everything honestly just seems a little easier and less scary. Because it's so easy to, like, hear, you know, defund the police and be like, oh my God, wait, but what am I going to do if this happens, you know? But I think with the abolition lens, it, like, things do clear up.
No, that's like, that's so real. Like, is it is scary? Like, for instance, my partner's motorcycle got stolen like 3 times over over this pandemic. And like, my partner, instead of being, you know, like, they were really upset, right? Like, their vehicle a lot to them. I think people who like motorcycles are kind of really nerdy about them, and my partner is one of them. You know, and every time, you know, the cops would call, say that, you know, they found this person and they're gonna, like, you know, lock them up, and we're like, what are you doing? Like, this is, we're in the middle of a pandemic. The person who, you know, they shouldn't have taken something that wasn't theirs, but that motorcycle is not worth their life. Physical distancing or social distancing doesn't exist in incarceration. People are contracting COVID every day in there. So, like, no, not lock up this guy. His life deserves more than that, deserves more respect. He was in a place maybe he couldn't respect, you know, my partner's property and, like, their relationship to it. But at the very least, like, they deserve the basic dignity and respect to, like, live.
Yeah, and I think it's powerful that you could see that in the face of something happening to you. Does that make sense? Because I think, like, a lot of times the reason why we rely on policing systems is because that fear, that kind of like almost like fight or flight, it's like, well, something has to happen to them in order for justice to be served. But it's definitely not the case, as we've seen.
No, like people, the majority of folks who are currently incarcerated in Hawaii are there related to substance abuse charges or poverty related stuff. Right. Like they're engaging in things to help them survive, like either they're stealing food, coping with their drug addiction, or they're experiencing like mental health issues. And the police like allows us to dehumanize people in our communities in that way, I think a lot about, like, because we just like sick these cops on them rather than building the conditions in which when a person feels like, you know, has harmed or is harming themselves or others, they feel that they have that support and that love.
Definitely. I think that just really affirms the notion that abolition is about normalizing empathy and compassion within our structures and systems. And that comes with eradicating the practice of criminalizing poverty, lack of access, and a lot more. So would you mind sharing some examples of pu'uhulua and the different ways that it acts as an alternative system to incarceration, and also how they're really connected to environmental justice and our relationship to Aina?
Ever since the 10K Black Lives Matter rally, I think of Joy Enomoto's line that replays in my head a lot. And I know it was mentioned in a prior episode where she said, genuine security means we build pu'uhonua within each other. And that's like resonated with me because, you know, back, like really back in the day when we used the kapu system and it was practiced, there was some like really, truly severe punishment that existed. They were, you know, practicing the straight up death penalty as a means of redress whenever you're perceived as slighting a god or someone of higher status or harming someone or the community, you know, like for instance, for hunting or fishing whenever you weren't supposed to, because that then impacted like your neighbors and your community ability to eat. So pu'uhonua was meant for people to seek refuge, like a literal heiau, like the one in South Kona, pu'uhonua o hanaunau, where, you know, when people have done harm and need to engage in what I believe it is a community-led transformative justice process. There was this understanding that if you voluntarily go to a pu'uhonua, you'd find love and grace and learn why it was harmful, and you would then unlearn that behavior. Pu'uhonua, it was like a physical safe space, like, and you nurtured your relationships to the aina and your loved ones and community. Like, look at what pu'uhonua o pu'uhulu anamauna did. Like, look at what pu'uhonua wainai has done with accepting people in and giving them shelter and feeding them and educating people. That is so beautiful. Like, I think about, you know, and talking about like environmental justice or injustice, there should be no cages on stolen land. The construction and the occupation of these cages is just insulting, and it desecrates not only Hawaiian land, but indigenous land everywhere, right? The resources, tons and tons of cement for metal, for clothing, all had to come from somewhere. And then those resources are used to hurt indigenous people. Prisons, they like reflect environmental injustice. What's happening outside is what's happening in the prison. Communities of color and low-income people are massively overrepresented in the prison population. We're talking about people with a lack of political representation, lack of healthcare, mental health services, substance abuse treatment, and other services, who are forcibly placed into an extremely physically, spiritually, and emotionally toxic environment. And then they're entirely independent on the state. I just think about how prisons just really cauterize our relationship to the land and then exploit it. We've pumped billions of dollars in Hawaii into the prison industrial complex here to keep people in dirty 8x10 cages with 2 to 3 other people. And during the pandemic, there have been these rolling lockdowns due to positive cases, which means people inside are not allowed to go outside. They're not allowed to get visits or phone calls or letters, and that can last anywhere from like days to weeks. The lucky ones who get to go outside are people who are on work furlough, and they're getting paid to $1 an hour forced to, like, you know, they have to do landscape work. Like that then becomes the relationship to the aina, is cleaning up after all of us, and then forced to help cops evict unsheltered people from Honolulu streets and throw away their belongings. Like, that is so traumatizing. And that's what the state has said is better than Pu'uhonua, which is mind-boggling.
Yeah, it just goes to show that, like, when I keep thinking about how you said, it's basically mass incarceration is a manifestation of how the state views Black and Indigenous people of color. And it's like, especially in Hawaii, where, and we touched on this in so many of our other episodes as well, where it's kind of viewed, at least from a tourism lens, or primarily through a tourism lens, it's so easy to forget that these relationships have been desecrated, violated in so many ways, and Pu'uhonua essentially regenerates that in small spaces of refuge and solace. We can also be building that within our communities, and it doesn't have to be like, I don't know, this ideal, right? Like it should be our reality.
In your organizing work, what are the narratives, campaigns, and strategies that have been used within the broader community to help folks understand abolition and mass incarceration through the lens that you've just shared with us today?
So I feel very privileged right now in this moment of the work I can do. Like, a typical day for me is talking story like this with people who are affected by the criminal legal system, whether, you know, they've served time or they have a loved one inside Hawaii's prisons and jails. Then I talk to a lot of people who've never spent a day in court but saw something on the news, or just truly care about people in our community and want real justice. And then from there, we spend time listening, learning, and like reading and trying to figure out, like, how can we bring more people in? Mm-hmm. And I think what's so beautiful in Hawaii is we love to talk story. Like, we love to hear stories. We love to know what's going on in each other's life because we're invested in each other. And it's like from those conversations that then we spark, oh, you know what? That thing, that's fucked up, right? Like, that's like, and who do we then go after, whether it's a lawmaker, state agency, or public official, to move on an issue? Talking about like COVID and jails, like, we can, as a community, like work to ensure that compassionate release of our kupuna, people with disabilities, pretrial detainees, or people nearing the end of their sentence, to protect them from COVID-19. Right. Mm-hmm. And like, once we humanize, talk about like the moms that are in there, the dads that are in there, the people who are like literal families being separated and people being separated from their homelands. We send them all over the place. And once we tap into that, I think that's how we start to break down some of those barriers of what prevents people from like going all in. And also, you know, I'm also part of like a local study and struggle abolitionist group that was started by Kanaka abolitionists, Noel Kakimoto and Leilani Maxera. You know, we use a study and struggle abolition, intersectionality, and care curriculum based out of Mississippi. And we get together and we talk story and we talk about colonialism and imperialism and feminism and heteropatriarchy and all the isms. And then we dream and read about and like, and we also run a first of its kind like abolitionist pen pal program in Hawaii.
What would you say we can do as a collective, as individuals, to not just educate ourselves but also be part of this broader movement that is growing rapidly?
I think, well, one, you can become a pu'uhonua pen pal, right? I would love that, because the carceral state literally thrives on our disconnectedness. It needs our bodies, are like the literal fuel to the prison industrial complex. A really, I think, rewarding way to help break down those barriers and organize against the prison industrial complex is you can just start forming meaningful friendships with people inside. Mm. Like, you can start talking to people about their day, what they care about. You can start recommending things for them to read and for you to read together and learn and listen. And you can find out by going, you can join our Pu'uhonua Pen Pal program by going to our Instagram and search hashtag Pu'uhonua Pen Pal, and you'll find information on how to sign up. Also, And also, if you have a loved one inside, you can submit their name to become a pen pal. I have like one more thing that could probably, that I think helps along. Like start talking about abolition. Like talk about it with me, with your friends, with your network. But please start also talking to lawmakers and city council during the legislative session about abolition. Like talk about abolishing cages and building pu'uhonua at prison oversight commission meetings and at your county police commission meeting. These legislative hearings and commission meetings are where you can voice your concerns about the environmental, racial, and economic impact prisons have in our communities. It's also where you can raise hell about police protecting property and profit over people. Like, mercy to the folks who should be held accountable for propping up these really harmful systems.
Thank you for sharing that. I love that you also gave us very distinct steps. Full educational program right there.
You know, we talked a bit about folks who fear of like, what if we get rid of cops? There's people that are gonna do X, Y, and Z. You know, Joy mentioned it in a previous episode that incarcerated people are often the victims of abuse, neglect, and harm themselves, right? Like, they're berated daily. They're yelled at daily. We've normalized sexual assault and abuse as part of the prison experience. You know, pandemic or not, they're not allowed to even hug their families when they go to visit. The system needs their bodies. It's fuel. So, of course, we need to continue to traumatize them. Because they need to be kept in this constant cycle of arrest, a cage, and repeat. Because the system, I think, was actually designed to ensure people got the love and care they needed to stop harming themselves and others, we wouldn't need cops and cages anymore. I think in the work of abolishing the prison industrial complex and reclaiming Puhonua, we're working to put out these fires. You know, we've all been so traumatized by the carceral system and punishment, but at the same time, we need to be creating the conditions and the relationships and the programs that will promote healthy and safe and loving communities. The most policed communities are not the most safe communities. The most safe communities are the ones where everybody, if they need help, they get it. If they, you know, everyone has food and they are sheltered and they are getting proper help and services. It's our job to envision, like, what would it look like to start building pu'uhonua everywhere in ourselves and each other? Start making that radical commitment that everyone is valuable and worthy of love. I'm really corny like that, but I'm like, it's the only reason why I like abolition, because I just get to be mushy the whole time.
I love that, because I think it's also like reinventing how we even view human security. You know, like it's the way that we learn about security is like guns and the military and all that. But essentially it's a freedom from fear. It's a freedom from insecurity, whether it's food, health, you know, shelter, any of that sort. And abolition just builds the foundation of that. And it's just beautiful in every way. So I really appreciate you sharing all those parts of abolition that people often leave out.
We're not saying that bad things won't happen, like that we won't, we're not saying that like people won't, you know, hurt others, but we are saying, how are we creating the conditions that make it impossible, right? That how are we making it so that people don't ever feel the desire to hurt someone else? And if, when they do, how are we making sure that we're supporting their success? Because once someone else's liberation becomes conditional, then ours do as well. So I need to make sure I'm extending that to everybody else. I feel like I've talked so much. Like, who are you? Like, who are like,
I shared so much. So I'm a student. I go to UH, and I was actually born and raised in Malaysia. Came to Hawaii for university. And I've been here for like 2.5 years-ish. I honestly, whenever, like, even like doing this right now, it feels very surreal, because not only did I like was never like exposed to any of this, and as I'm sure a lot of people who were born raised here weren't as well, but I don't want to sound cheesy, but it just kind of felt like I felt called to it. Talking about justice and liberation just always felt, once I learned about it, it just always felt like so central to what I studied and what I want to pursue. It's interesting though, because I feel like I make a lot of connections to the systems that I grew up around, things like LGBTQ plus communities, and how, you know, that's not even like something that's legal in Malaysia, right? And so when I think about even things like abolition and liberation, it's also, it's something that's so global. Policing, incarceration, it's like, how did these things even end up being normal? I also just learned about West Papua. So connected to this global colonial movement. It's crazy.
Yeah, it feels in a lot of ways, like once you become open, like you see it. I think like growing up here, you feel so far removed from like the ideas of like, oh, slavery and imperialism, like that doesn't exist, right? Like we're all American and all that kind of stuff. Yeah. And then like now learning that just like it's a few, like it's 2-3 hour plane ride. And there are Pacifica siblings, like Black Pacifica siblings, who are literally being enslaved right now and facing genocide. And then that disconnection was fostered from old white dudes who like made up the words Melanesian and Polynesian and Micronesian. Those are our siblings. And yeah, and I just think of how I know they haven't forgotten us, but we've forgotten them. Sorry. Talking about West Papua like really makes me upset. Sorry.
No, I honestly, it's wild because like when I started learning about it, it sent chills down my spine because my mom's family and my mom as well was born and raised in Jakarta. None of us had any idea. It's your entire body just feels like, oh my gosh, like have I been living in, what world have I been living in? Like how have I been separated from this? And it's chilling to think that it's all part of a larger system of erasing and genocide. And not saying that things like the Holocaust, I'm not trying to invalidate that, but when we think about genocide, that's what we think about, like the Holocaust. Mm-hmm. And it happens on so many scales to Indigenous communities, even right now. It's not something of history.
Yeah. And it's so purposeful, right? Like it's so purposeful to make sure that we're not talking to each other across like international borders. It's so purposeful for us to like be siloed. I feel like in the work, it's our we're called to reclaim those connections again and like reclaim that, like, and to be like, it's our birthright to love each other.
Have you have had any activism work around that in Hawaii?
So with our like little abolitionist group that we, you know, study and stuff, or like last unit we did was all about really diving into the international connections to abolition, you know, and talking about like Palestine and talking about Africa and as a whole. And then I was like, there's such a huge divide between us just from island to island. And it's so sad because like we know that our ancestors were constantly traveling and visiting each other. And like now it's like they've made it so hard for us to like reclaim those relationships. It's something that I'm definitely like, okay, so like what do we got to do to make friends over there?
Yeah. Yeah, honestly. And it's like, I feel like having lived here for a little bit, like I've seen how like rage and emotions of like reclaiming and resistance is really powerful. And I've always been taught that those things were bad, you know, and it's like you shouldn't respond with anger, whatever, that kind of thing. Like a lot of toxic positivity stuff, really trying to like think about that in that space where like, because I know that a lot of Indonesian human rights activists are not allowed to talk about it or living in exile, whatever. And it's also about like reclaiming that space to even speak about these things. I mean, obviously West Papuans should have the first say and should be at the table, but along with that, like we shouldn't be silencing people who are trying to amplify those voices either. That's happening constantly. So it's scary for sure. And like, I'm trying to understand how all that political shit works in Indonesia. It's a huge country, but.
And it's like that thing too of like, we don't have guaranteed safety, right? Because the U.S. empire makes it so that it is scary when you speak out against anything. If you at all start questioning and start building to these connect, right? Like Black Panthers became threatening because they were talking to everybody and they were feeding everybody. We were like ripped to allow the state to dictate whether or not you started talking about, like, right, once MLK started talking really intentionally around anti-capitalism and communism, like, that's when he got shot. That's when Fred Hampton got shot. All these Black Lives Matter activists popping up who, from ending police brutality to being like, oh, how do we look at the system of a whole? I've been home, like, back into Hawaii for about a year now, and it was, like, I think I spent like a lot of like the first 6 months just like getting acclimated back to being home. and then like trying to figure out like, okay, how do I plug in?
Right. How like, did you like navigate that?
Well, I think, you know, it's kind of easier for me because I'm from here. So I just,
yeah, like new
and
people.
I think that, and I work for the ACLU. So most folks are just like, oh, they want to like talk to me a lot of the time. So I have like, I'll say like, it's a weird thing because I don't think that like, my job should exist. Don't think the organizing should exist. Like I'm just a professional friend maker, but under the guise of being paid by like professional organizers were paid by politicians or PACs or unions or nonprofits to persuade people to transform their like anger or hurt or grief into to strategic action that sometimes still invest in the system that hurt them. Work I talk about police reform, not police abolition. And then I also worked in like, a couple of like legislative sessions.
Oh, that must be interesting.
It is. I think it's a really good experience. And you can, you know, when we're talking about like indoctrination, it is ripe for that environment. Like you're very much like everyone surrounding you is all very invested in holding up the institution of like the state legislature and the U.S. It's all about reform. Yeah. It's all about, I recommend it, or like at least interning to like understand when you're doing abolition work, who are you, who are then people that you have to start persuading, or who are people that you shouldn't spend as much time on.
That's real. Yeah. I've actually been interning with Planned Parenthood this past semester. That's been so interesting because you're being put in this position where you have to convince people that your body matters and others' bodies matters. And it's like, I don't even know sometimes, like, who are we speaking to? Like, I know it's like politicians, but it's a weird dynamic, right? You're like speaking to a state or like a body of people who make decisions about your existence. So legislature is like very odd.
Right. Cause like, it's not like they reflect the actual diversity of Hawaii at all. Like they don't, a lot of them are older. A lot of them are very blah. A lot of them are at all impacted by the things that we just like talked about in the last hour. Like it just doesn't enter their consciousness because they live in an entirely different social economic class, or they're just entirely invested and bought in to the state legislature and all that. So yeah, I mean, like I worked for the first openly queer legislator to ever vote against marriage equality. Like she, things like that happen. And I was in the governor's office, like interning, volunteering when all the birtherism was going down around Obama. Like you start to understand like why politicians make certain moves or don't, and then get frustrated about it, and then like I'm gonna jump ship and go to the nonprofit world.
I'm definitely intrigued by policy making for sure. I mean, it does dictate a lot of what we do, but it's also one of those things where like, does it just, you know, disenfranchise you and makes you like really jaded, or does it invigorate you to like want to do things beyond that?
I think like we all have different roles in the movement, right? Yeah. Like for me, I prefer to stay out of there and just like help people to navigate it. Like my partner, they're a lobbyist, and so like they're constantly like thinking about the kinds of policy, what to advocate for, whereas I'm like, well, my friend who just got out of you know, prison or jail says that we need to work on this, and that's what we're gonna work on.
With your role in ACLU, like what have people like said to you about your work, not direct like personally, but just kind of like what are the general narratives that you hear in the community?
I work for ACLU, and one, most folks don't know what it is. I think in Hawaii, like we don't, it has to do with a number of things. ACLU is mostly known for their court and legal cases, and like I'm part of like this new field department. The affiliate is investing more into community relationships. I absolutely love my job. I find purpose in it. But like the major criticisms I hear is like, oh, we're just like a left-wing liberal crybabies, or that there are really like good and honest critiques because like the ACLU takes up like constitutional protections in a really, I think sometimes in a stupid way. ACLU has gone to court to protect the rights of like white supremacists and Nazis to say their stupid shit. We get the most flack when it comes to stuff around policing and prisons and poverty, like around house assistance. We're very vocal about opposing the sweeps, very vocal about police misconduct, and very vocal about like all the prison and jail conditions, which aren't, you know, a lot of other nonprofits are built around talking about those things, but talking about like, oh, provide services. And we're like, so I guess like from that, but like, you know, all the professionally, like that's kind of what I hear. And then like personally, it's all like the regular stuff that people mean things people say. But then there are like the really great times where people are like, they really do appreciate like a place where they could plug into and talk about these issues and then also see a way forward. Like last year we introduced a bill to end driver's license stoppers. And like that came directly out of community. Like something like 18% of people driving right now have a stopper on their license. That's crazy. Right? Like they have fines and fees that the stop, but you know, the government says that you can't drive. But they need to, because we're like so car reliant here. Mm. And like right now, if you want to catch public transportation, the bus drivers are driving around with COVID.
Yeah. And I think that's what, like when I learned about ACLU, that's what drew me to ACLU. It's like the community aspect of it. It's like, you're not working for a corporation, you know, like post-graduation, it's like, where do I want to put my energy? Mm-hmm. So it's like, I think it's really easy to fall into things for survival. Right. And it's completely understandable, but if it directly contends with your values, like, I don't know, it's a hard thing to grapple with.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Right. And like reckoning that you deserve better than just survival, right? Like you're, yeah, and you're worth it. Held up in your productivity, or like you actually deserve to like pursue whatever it is you're passionate about and get paid well for it. I can talk about that all day, because I'm just like, it's especially if you're like into organizing, it's frustrating here in Hawaii because there doesn't seem to be a real investment in community voices around like these issues. Like I'm frustrated with organizing as an industry, like as a profession, but also that, like, I know so many people who organize and work on campaigns or work on like the like different issues, and they're getting paid so low, or they don't have any health benefit, or they don't have, and I'm like, yeah, we're gonna have to unionize all at one point. So that it sets the standard and be passionate about it. Like, there needs to be some sort of standard.
I really appreciate like hearing you talk about your perspectives on it, because I feel like, especially this year, I've seen, you know, a lot of talk about activists not being paid. Just especially like, you know, like the influencer life, like the fact that a lot of corporations would seek out organizers to do the work for them and then just assume that that would be free and stuff. It's just, I don't know, it just makes me think about how it's really connected to capitalism as a whole and how we value different things. And even in academia, like the way that academics are definitely not paid enough, or like PhD students or grad students in general are just, you know, put to work like crazy. It's just sad, and it's all connected to,
like, I'm at least kind of like heartened that I know that Local 5 is legit, and like, and how they take with Lisa Grandinetti and stuff, but I know so many other organizers who are struggling and like shouldn't have to, because they do baller ass work. And like so many people like rely in the community, like rely on them to like important information about like the environment or like reproductive health or education and healthcare, like literally relied on to pass on the information to more people, but can't make rent or struggling with rent or childcare.
Thank you so much again. I seriously appreciate it a lot. I love the work that you do, so it's just exciting to have you here.
Deep mahalo to Anna for hosting this episode, to Lauren and Carly for editing and research, and of course, to Shayna for the important work you do. We hope this conversation put a fire in all your bellies to step into 2021 with love, empathy, righteous anger, and action. We got a lot of work to do. Oh my God. We got so much work to do, but we do it because all we have is each other. Stay rooted. Happy New Year!